You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, The Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scars. We are coming to you on the afternoon of Sunday, July 19th, 2020, right about midway between the second and third round of games taking place in the MLS's back tournament, and right in the heat of the knockout stage of the NWSL Chaos Cup. We've got a great show for you tonight, a comprehensive and a long show, so get buckled up. But first, let me bring in my co-host. First, the man who is not Matt Pollard, Daniel Sperry.
Yeah, not Matt Pollard. Matt Pollard's back. I told you he'd be back, folks.
And Rachel Krieger. Rachel, I want to say you're welcome for the chaos that I brought upon you over the course of the last 48 hours.
You know, I would have been more angry if there was extra time, because that means I wouldn't be going to bed until like 3:30 in the morning. So I'm only slightly angry at you.
Okay, let's get into it, folks. Rachel, why don't we start with the NWSL Challenge Cup? Where would you like to begin, my friend?
How I'm slightly angry with you? No, I'm kidding.
Yes, let's start there.
So, as everyone knows, Matt is the king of chaos, and Matt brought said chaos without even knowing to the NWSL quarterfinals. Three of the four top four teams are out of the tournament now, including, shock noises please, the North Carolina Courage, which nobody thought would ever happen. I have a theory on that, and I'll get to that in a minute. But the quarterfinals, there were a lot of penalty kicks. There was only one goal scored throughout the whole quarterfinals from Morgan Weaver of the Portland Thorns in that shocking win over the North Carolina Courage. A lot of really good goalkeeping happening, especially from Britt Eckerstrom, who had to fill in for Bella Bixby for the Thorns, who also had an amazing tournament, but confirmed that she had, I believe it's an ACL injury, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But lots of good goalkeeping. Eckerstrom put on a clinic. Kaylin Sheridan was awesome. And Jane Campbell just proved that she is the queen of penalty kicks in the entire NWSL and possibly women's soccer. The Houston game against Utah was probably the most interesting game, but for all the wrong reasons. There was, Matt's favorite word, a lot of chaos, and a lot of that had to do with the officiating and how bad Danielle Chesky was. There was a poll reporter there, but the questions were not answered, and the media association is still kind of going through that and running through circles with that. So buckle up for all of that kind of craziness. That's bad chaos, though, as Matt knows. But, like I said, there was only one goal from Morgan Weaver in the whole quarterfinals. But definitely some upsets, more of some really good goalkeeping, of course. But my theory for the Courage was that so every team had to play four quote unquote group stage games, because as we know, with the Orlando Pride pulling out of the tournament, there were only eight teams competing, and only eight teams were going to go to the quarterfinals anyway. So all of the group stage games were pretty much just to see who was going to seed and who was going to play who. So North Carolina clinched the number one seed after the third match. I believe that was against the Chicago Red Stars, and they won all of their group stage games. So they had the number one seed clinched, but yet Paul Riley still elected to start his main starting 11. And I think that had led to kind of a down performance from the Courage in the quarterfinals, because they just looked, frankly, they looked gassed. And U.S. Soccer, there's a good article from Jeff Kasouf at The Equalizer about how U.S. Soccer is managing minutes at the Challenge Cup, which is just bonkers, and I'll get to that later. But U.S. Soccer is managing the women's national team players or those who are on the fringe of the national team. And as we know, there's a lot of national team players on the Courage. So they looked gassed. And I think, you know, it's hard to really blame a loss on anyone, but I think Paul Riley needs to take some of the blame here. I think he should have given some of those younger players for North Carolina a shot in their last group stage match against Sky Blue, one that they didn't like have to win, or even if they lost, it wouldn't have meant anything because they had already clinched that that number one seed. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on the quarterfinals, or if you want me to jump into the previews for the semifinals.
Let's look ahead at the semifinals.
Okay, so the semifinals, I'm really excited about the first semifinal game because, as most of our listeners probably know by now, I'm from Pittsburgh, and there are two Pittsburgh players going against each other in the semifinals, Megan Klingenberg for the Portland Thorns and Veronica Lotzko for the Houston Dash. So that's the first game on Wednesday. Thorns, they might be without Lindsey Horan. She took herself out of the quarterfinal match against North Carolina. And like I said, U.S. Soccer is managing minutes for those women's national team players, and Vlatko Andonovsky has been on scene for every single game. I think the player to watch is going to be Raquel Rodriguez. And obviously, I think you're going to have to keep eye on Morgan Weaver after a strong quarterfinal game. But Houston, I think they're going to have some good pressure as well. They've been super cheeky in the tournament. So I think that'll be a good one to watch for. And then later in the evening is Sky Blue and the Chicago Red Stars. Sky Blue made it to the quote-unquote playoffs, and they made it past the round, which is very exciting. But there really isn't a real attack for either side. The Chicago Red Stars have this looming dark cloud over their head named Sam Kerr's absence, and that has definitely plagued the team. I think I said this to Dan last week. You just can't replace a player like Sam Kerr overnight and in one season, really. But it's not a good look when Rachel Hill, Katie Johnson, and Kelia Ohiwat have not scored a single goal, and those are the main starting strikers. So, but also, Sky Blue doesn't have too much of an attack presence as well. I think they only had two shots on goal against the Washington Spirit and goalkeeper Aubrey Bledsoe. But two semifinals that surely aren't going to disappoint. It's going to be interesting to see another team that isn't named North Carolina lift the trophy this year. So, and you've got two teams that are used to the playoffs in Chicago and in Portland. So,
good stuff there. Dan, do you have anything to add or any comments? How have you enjoyed the tournament?
You know, I haven't been watching it as much as I should have, but I've enjoyed. I know Rachel's giving me a thumbs down on our video chat here, but you know, it's been I was shocked, honestly, that the Courage lost. I did pay attention to that game. Rachel the night before, Rachel had hyped up the Courage just so hard. Literally, our whole talking point for the first part of that podcast was, why are the Courage probably going to win the whole thing? And then they went and lost to the Thorns. So I enjoy. It might be a whole just U.S. soccer like cumulative chaos between MLS and NWSL. My dog is growling at something. I don't know what it is. So sorry if the mic's picking that up. But I've enjoyed what I have been able to see of this tournament. Surprised the Courage lost, but I will be looking forward to the semis and ultimately the final here. It's always fun to see the team that you expect to win it all lose, and then you really like, wow, who's actually going to win this thing? And it kind of makes you think a little bit more. So it'll be fun to watch.
Yeah, I thought the game.
Whose curse is more legit, mine or the Orlando's Pride's and their Stan account?
It might be Rachel's.
I am known for that. I'm sorry, Matt. Go ahead.
Just maybe.
Okay. Yeah. You know, I am someone. I have a very Colin Cowherdy view when it comes to dynasties and just teams that tend to dominate in any particular sports league or conference or anything like that. In terms of, I think people are drawn to dynasties. We want to see dynasties fail. We also want to better understand them. And there's certainly a fair amount of hate watching. So maybe not this year, Dan, but certainly in years prior and probably next year, if the NBA gets back to normal, watching the Golden State Warriors is interesting because of how they have changed the game of basketball. and also wanting to see if and when the wheels are going to come off for Mr. Wardell, Stephen Curry, and company. I think we could say the same thing. Everybody's going to be really interesting to see what happens with the New England Patriots if the NFL season happens this season because Tom Brady's not there. So finally, we get the data point we've always wanted of one, you know, can one exist without the other, or was really Brady just super great, or was Belichick creating a system that ultimately made it work, and Brady was just another potentially expendable cog in that machine. And so we kind of saw that finally in the inevitable Portland Thorns, you know, with the North Carolina Courage being a thorn in their back, being able to take them down. I thought the Houston Dash have been really, really fun for me personally. And I know this is going to really tug at my heartstrings, Rachel, when we get to Dash versus Thorns in the pick'ems. But then I think the Red Stars have also been really, really fun. I am like one more great play away from probably just turning my Twitter account into a Casey Short Stan account. What she's gone through in this tournament, I think both emotionally off the field in terms of also on play, has been really interesting. And finally, it looks like the Red Stars are actually mounting something to where they might be able to win something of significance instead of being this team that appeared to have this great potential and kind of Julie Ertz just trying to hold everything together and it coming apart. So we'll see what's going to happen, but it's certainly going to be chaos this coming Wednesday. Let's get on to the other chaos that is happening in Orlando, and that is the MLS is Back tournament. We will be doing green light, red light, yellow light, but first we should acknowledge we won't be covering anything in Group A for a couple of reasons, folks. First of all, in the episode that I missed, in which Dan overshot but not super bad on my overall weight there, Mr. Daniel. I'm not offended, certainly. The Group A was about to finish at that point, and so right now we have Orlando City and Philadelphia Union both on 6 points. They play each other, and the two teams with 0 points, 4 losses collectively, Inter-Miami and New York City FC, play each other. So Inter and NYCFC can get at most 3 points. So those first two, those top two seeds have already been clinched. Orlando is through the knockout rounds as one of the top two in the group. Same thing for Philadelphia Union. They'll be playing each other effectively for seeding to see who is the first, who is the group winner and who is the second place. And at this point, Inter-Miami and New York City FC pretty much just both need a win, and they probably need, like a lot of other teams in this tournament, need a lot of help elsewhere if they want to hope to be one of the best third teams in the group. So none of our green, yellow, red light will be covering anything in Group A. So Rachel, I will throw it to you first. Give me your green lights.
My green light is Diego Rossi and LAFC in a one-way El Trafico. I think we're all on the same page that El Trafico is a good name. I'm not sure. Matt, I remember you yelling about it one time. Dan, maybe you've yelled about it too, but I love El Trafico. It was a really, really good game to watch, albeit I was, you know, teetering and watching both NWSL and El Trafico, but the highlights were even better the next day. It was an amazing game, a ton of goals, and just big yikes to the LA Galaxy, but we'll get there later. But LAFC, I mean, just absolutely dominant. And it's great to see that a team, you know, Carlos Vela is super duper talented and nobody's ever going to take that away from him or the Galaxy, but it's nice to see other players step up and prove that it's not just a one-man team. So LAFC, Diego Rossi, you get a green light.
Dan.
Green light's going to Kyrie Shelton. He's been one of Sporting Kansas City's best players outside of Alan Pulido. You saw his finish in the first game against Minnesota United. He did get the own goal at the end. Very unlucky that was even an own goal off of him. But Kyrie's been continuing to be a headache for a lot of teams. He gets the ball and out on the wing, out wide. And then he drives right at the back line. He's not always necessarily looking to cut in. He's literally just looking to drive straight at the goalkeeper. It almost feels like more of like a what in basketball what you'd call a slasher, someone that you're gonna pass the ball to, and they're constantly streaking from north south to the hoop the entire time. That's how Kyrie Shelton feels. He is in and around the box. He's been dangerous. He's always kind of on the hunt, lurking for another goal. And you saw the really good finish against the Colorado Rapids on Friday night. He has scored 3 goals and I believe has an assist since he has returned to Sporting Kansas City. That is more than he scored in the entire full season and season before that with New York City FC in 2017 and 2018 combined. He has already scored more and assisted more in four games. So Kyrie Shelton has been a man possessed since he came back from Germany. It might be causing a few problems for Sporting Kansas City. Johnny Russell has been out on the left and has a hard time getting involved in the attack. But if the goals continue to come, victories 3 out of 4 continue to come, I don't think Sporting Kansas City are really going to complain all that much.
And then my green light's got to be Columbus Crew, who I think have been the most impressive team through two games played for every team in this tournament. 2 wins, 6 points, a comprehensive dismantling of the FC Cincinnati backline in a game where I think Columbus Crew's social media Twitter people were more awake than FC Cincinnati's backline was in the final 10 minutes. And kind of the question coming out of that game was, is Cincy that bad or is Columbus that good? And Columbus Crew made the New York Red Bulls absolutely look silly. They took them apart defensively and gave them almost nothing from a defensive standpoint. I look at this team and, okay, they might not have a Carlos Vela or a Jose Martinez. Not that either of those two players are in this tournament, but I don't see any distinct weaknesses. You know, I think, Dan, we'll get to some of your thoughts that I probably agree with you about the Portland Timbers a little bit later, but I don't see, if I'm an opponent running up against them in a knockout game, I don't see a distinct way for me to attack them or a weakness that I can exploit to create space and then ultimately take advantage of that space. And then there's so many ways that they can beat you. They've scored on set pieces. Zalarayan has been fantastic. He has a great cast around him. And Giassi Zardes appears to be in form with some really great finishes. And the system's also clearly working because Zardes has gotten a couple of tap-ins as well. They appear to be the team through 108 minutes played that are firing on all cylinders. I don't see any distinct weaknesses. They don't have any key injuries or anybody other than the question about the one, I think, test that came back positive that ended up being negative. So the process for them preparing for this tournament and getting inside the bubble and getting acquainted to the bubble wasn't particularly a variable. Every single other team in this tournament, I'd say, maybe other than LAFC, but the biggest thing I can say about them is they just don't have their key match winner that stirs the drink in Carlos Vela. I just, if I'm a coach going up against them in a knockout round game, I don't see an easy way for me to take advantage of them other than inherently playing to, we're going to be the more conservative team, we're going to make it hard on them and hope they have an off day and we're able to create something. So if Columbus Crew are firing on all cylinders, they are absolutely a favorite for me in this tournament. Let us move on to Yellow Light, and I will throw it to you, Mr. Daniel.
Yeah, so my my yellow light on this is actually going to be a combination of Minnesota United and Portland. These two teams are in a relatively safe spot headed in. Portland is certainly safe going into the knockout rounds at this point, but Minnesota United is just safe at the moment. Probably will be safe in the long run, but both teams have been, according to American Soccer Analysis, expected goals plots have been were expected to be outscored through their first two games twice over. In the first game, Minnesota United, despite the own goal for Sporting Kansas City, had a 1.2 expected goals difference. Kansas City had a 1.43. Kansas City was more likely to score one or two goals than they were any of them. Minnesota United was more likely to score zero or one goals, and they ended up scoring two. Look on to Minnesota United's next game. They're more likely to score zero. RSL is more likely to score one. 0-0. Okay. An even 0-0 boring draw. Neither team actually hit one expected goals here. Portland Timbers, though, they were more likely to score zero goals than they were two against the Houston Dynamo last night. Dynamo should have scored one or two, possibly even three. The Dynamo had a better chance, according to the expected goals thing, had a better chance through the chances that they created of scoring three goals than Portland did scoring even two. According to American Soccer Analysis, probability data and all that stuff on that, Houston, given the outcome and the expected goal range, it was a 63% chance that Houston was going to win that match. The same thing goes for the Portland LA Galaxy game. It was a 51% chance that the LA Galaxy were to win that match. Only it was more likely that that match would have ended in a draw than it would have a Portland win. So what am I saying here? Well, both Minnesota United and both Portland have been incredibly lucky in the results that they're getting. My biggest question is, what does that do to Portland? I think is a little bit easier to draw it up to Steve Clark. He's one of the best goalkeepers in the game. Last couple of years, he had last season, I believe, he had the greatest difference in goals allowed versus expected goals against for any MLS keeper through 17 games. So he had the biggest difference between those two. Clark is a fantastic goalkeeper. That might be attributed to that Portland. Minnesota United, not sure where it is because they're without Aiko Parra. Is it just the fact that they've turned both games into pretty sloggy midfield affairs? Sporting Kansas City just didn't get off the mark in their game against them, and RSL kind of regressed to the mean of what we expect from their attack. Not sure the answers to that question on Minnesota United and Portland end, but it is a big question mark for me. Is what they are doing in this tournament, is it sustainable going forward, even into a potential regular season afterwards? Is it going to be sustainable in the knockout rounds? I'm not sure. It's an interesting thing to look at, and I still have two very big question marks surrounding Minnesota United and Portland, despite the early praise that they have gotten in this tournament.
Rachel, your yellow light.
So before I get into my yellow light, I have to apologize to my yellow light from last week. Columbus Crew, yeah, I know I harped on you a little bit for beating FC Cincinnati because, you know, FC Cincinnati is not great. But yeah, they're good at soccer, that's for sure. So I am sorry to Columbus and Caleb Porter, but you definitely have a support over here, I guess just because geographically nonetheless. But anyway, my yellow light is DC United, and I mainly say DC because of a couple reasons. Both of their results have been draws, and I think that a DC United team with as much talent as they do have right now, I think they're better than the draws that they have been competing in. And I also say that because of the disciplinary report. Junior Morena had two yellow cards in the first game. Felipe had a yellow card. Russell Canoes had a yellow card. And in the last game against New England, all three yellow cards in the match went to DC United as well. So I think everyone looks at their upcoming match against Montreal and says, oh, that's a shoo-in win for them. But it's just, it's one wrong thing that happens and, you know, chaos can ensue and the whole match can just go completely another different direction. So I'm a little nervous about DC. I think they might be able to squeak in as a one of the better third place teams, but I'm not 100% sold on them. And yeah, they're still missing key pieces. They're missing Paul Areola, but I've also, you know, we always talk about Bill Hamid being one of the better goalkeepers in MLS, and I have not really been too impressed with him at MLS's back. So DC United, yellow light for them, and kind of intrigued to see what happens against Montreal.
And then my yellow light is going to be a team that you got to witness one of their greatest moments and something that's very on theme for them live while recording last episode, Dan, and that is the San Jose Earthquakes. Yes, they have 4 points. Currently, they are first in Group B. Granted, Chicago Fire and Vancouver Whitecaps both just on one games played. So obviously a team could jump up and be close to level with them. And obviously if the Fire were to win the game in hand they have in advance, they would be on 6 points and the San Jose Earthquakes would be on 4 points. I think San Jose had a really good performance and overall a good result against the Seattle Sounders in their first game with their man-marking system. Obviously, there was a lot bad that happened against Vancouver. There was a lot good that happened, and ultimately the good ended up outweighing the bad. I'm still not entirely convinced that this roster, from a fitness and a talent standpoint, is in a position to execute the system as Matias Almeida has. And I'm not convinced that just given the fact that you're going to be playing for the rest of the tournament, you know, games every 3 to 5 days, depending on the schedule and when they're playing during the knockout rounds, if they do make it to the knockout rounds, if they're going to be able to just sustain it in the heat and then potentially having to go from playing a morning game to a super late night game, you know, whereas, you know, one of those games you're getting up at 5 a.m. local time, the other game you're probably still up from the adrenaline at 4 or 5 a.m. Or, you know, Shea Salinas is playing darts with Danny Hoosens, for example. So I'm still not convinced that they have a match winner. So I think good on them to get a result in their first two games. This is a team that, when the original four teams in Group B were announced, I was suspicious about whether or not they would make it to the knockout rounds. I would have not had them. I would have not had them going anywhere in the knockout rounds. Obviously, with 4 points through two games, I think that they're in a great position to advance. But there's a bunch of the same concerns that I had about them when Almeida took over, and we didn't see a whole lot of changes in the roster. The same concerns that I had that were ultimately led to their demise last season are the very concerns that I have for them in this tournament, and how long can they keep it up? Because at some point, just the adrenaline rush of whether it's Shea Salinas or Chris Wondolowski, or anybody else just trying to save them, when a lot of things that are structurally flawed about them are putting them in some of these deep holes. So we'll see what ends up happening. Obviously, they've got one game left to go in the group stage. It will be against the Chicago Fire. So if they get a result in that one, that should definitely put them through the knockouts. If they win that game, that could probably catapult them to being the top team in the group. But I'd have some serious concerns about this team if they were going up against one of the more well-rounded and structurally sound teams in this MLS Is Back tournament. With that, let's head on over to our red lights, Daniel.
I'll make one quick parting point about the San Jose Earthquakes. In that game against the Vancouver Whitecaps, they were more likely to score four than Vancouver was going to score two goals in that game. So it was what they did in that game. They should have won. They were the rightful winners based on the chances that they created and their own finishing. And they even they did outdo the Seattle Sounders in expected goals, 1.1 to 0.87. It's a little bit closer in that one, but they are outperforming teams and outchancing them, despite some of the even grovels from their own supporters, which I might get into a little bit more on my last words. But when it comes to my yellow light, my red light, sorry, I'm looking at you, Frank the Snooze, Frank the Boring. I mean, there's plenty of little puns that we can go on that last name. But for the love of God, Frank de Boer's got to learn to adapt. But the problem is that over his entire career, every single halfway decent team that he's been fired from, Crystal Palace, Inter Milan, etc., 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 it has been an unwillingness to change and adapt when things do not fit his system in terms of what the players are. He went on to Crystal Palace and then said, hey guys, we're going to run a 3-4-3 when we have like two incredible, like the only halfway decent center backs we have are two incredibly slow and immobile giants that cannot mark in space. And he said, cool, we're going to do this, and almost got Crystal Palace relegated, and they were saved by Big Sam at the end. I mean, what he has done every single where he has gone, outside of Ajax, which has a history and a youth development that support a 3-4-3 system, and it has been that way for the last 15, 20 years, and maybe at least 5 to 10 years prior to De Boer's arrival there. That's really the only true club that he has had success at. Inter Milan, gone. Absolutely run out of town at Inter Milan, and had them. This is the first year that they've even been like close to Europe since his arrival since Mourinho years, and when De Boer replaced whoever was the joke that they had in charge there. De Boer's got issues with adapting and changing. If you look at the team and the way and the roster composition and what Atlanta United are dealing with, they are not suited to run a 3-4-3, especially when you're running a center defensive midfielder and Mo Adams at center back. This is not going to work. You're asking him. He's been out of position. His positioning was the complete fault for it. You have George Bello that you're playing as a left mid instead of a true left back, a wing back. They have the ability to run a 4-3-3, a four in the back with a holding midfielder, and plenty of attacking midfielders that have left backs and right backs that are good, solid, and would probably do better for chance creation. You could throw Adam John up top to be somebody that PT and Barco can play 1-2s off of. John can do it. His nickname is Pillow Feet. He's got a great first touch for how big he is. He's got a decent pass as well. The problem is that De Boering is going to be De Boering, and he is going to implement whatever he thinks should be done regardless of what is actually feasible, and he's continuing to do it, and he's continuing to frustrate Atlanta United supporters. I know there's the Frank De Boer out account that everybody loves to just like to pay attention to on Twitter, but really, like, Frank De Boer's stubbornness is costing Atlanta United. And the only reason Atlanta United really got saved last year was Joseph Martinez went super cyan mode on everybody. So that's really where it's at. It's down to Frank De Boer's tactics and his unwillingness to change. And he wants to implement his 3-4-3, and he's either going to do it until he gets fired, or every decent player that they've got on the roster right now is gone, and he's replaced it with players that fit his boring European model that really only worked at a place that had a long history of developing players for that system. So yellow light is Frank, or red light is Frank De Boer. It's been bad. Atlanta United has been awful. They deserve to go home. The best part is they could probably win against Columbus and they could still not make it out of the group. They may still be last to Cincinnati because of the way things have gone for them so far. So De Boer's got to change if they want to even have a shot at getting out of this, and they got to root for the New York Red Bulls. And if I'm the New York Red Bulls, I just make a handshake 0-0 draw or a 1-1 draw with FC Cincinnati and keep Atlanta at the bottom of the group. But that's on to some more team chaos stuff. But I guess I should throw this to Rachel, right? Rachel, who's your red light?
My red light is the Toronto FC defense because they gave up 2 penalty kicks to the Montreal Impact. The first penalty kick came after Chris Mavinga brought down Romel. Help me with this last name, guys.
Kyoto.
Sure. Awesome. So bad penalty giveaway there for Toronto. And then the other one came in the 90th plus 5 minutes of stoppage time from a handball from Laurent Simon. And, like, granted, at that point, the score was Toronto up 4-2, I believe. And, you know, it's tough for Montreal to mount a super big comeback like that. But you're giving them the confidence and the momentum to do so when you set them up for a penalty and then Montreal converts. So I think that Toronto's defense needs to kind of clean up their act. Yeah, they got 3 points, but they also drew against a DC United team that just didn't look quite as crisp and sharp in that match. So I think if Toronto, you know, I think they're going to advance, but they need to be a lot smarter on defense if they're going to be on top of Group C. So they are my red light this week.
Your points are taken on the San Jose Earthquakes, Dan. That's why they were my yellow light rather than a red light, certainly given their results. But there's still a lot of things that are going on with that I have concerning them. Having all 10 of your field players on a corner kick within 30 yards of goal is a question. So certainly it's a yellow light. It could very easily become a green light. But in any case, we don't want to turn this into Matt and Dan ranting about the San Jose Earthquakes. So to get to my red light, we'll talk about two teams who haven't done anything good relative to the San Jose Earthquakes. And those are the Colorado Rapids and the LA Galaxy. The Rapids had probably their worst performance and worst start since Robin Fraser took over. It's probably their worst game that they've had since Anthony Hudson was still the head coach of the Rapids when they lost 2-0 to Real Salt Lake a week ago today at time of recording. And then they had what I thought was overall a really good start. They played 60 really good minutes of soccer, and then some officiating came in and became a factor. They got upset about VAR. I don't fully understand the cognitive dissonance that we've seen surrounding soccer fans around the world, where when VAR converts a call that goes in your favor, you think that it's good and you're glad it exists, but then VAR's the stupidest thing and it's ruining the game and it needs needs to be torn out and destroyed, and every single person who's been involved with VAR needs to be fired and never hired in soccer again. When the call goes against your way, it was a textbook dogzo for me against against Danny Wilson. Dan, we could talk about this if you want, but Benazee with the kind of off-ball elbow, incidental or maybe just conveniently there with his running motion on Graham Zusi, based on the letter of the law and how it was called last year with VAR, could have easily been a red card. David Gantar didn't lose the plot in this game. He decided in the first 20 minutes that he was going to completely swallow his whistle, and neither team was happy about that. Both of them sustained what they thought were pretty harsh tackles that were not called as fouls. Sporting Kansas City had a little bit more composure and chose to deal with it, even though going down 1-0, and the Colorado Rapids did not. And I think it was a microcosm of their composure or lack thereof it in the 72nd minute when Jack Price was given a straight red card for abusive language towards David Gantar, and that was kind of all she wrote. So, that's so Rapids in that a season had a whole lot of promise, and then now it's mid-July, and the season's effectively over, and the Rapids aren't going to win or compete for anything significant. They need a mathematical miracle involving at least four of the other groups just for them to make it to the knockout rounds, and that starts with them having to beat Minnesota United, potentially with a third-choice goalkeeper and a couple of players missing due to red cards. So a bunch of stuff happened that maybe wasn't outside their control, but they could choose to control their reactions, and they weren't able to do that. And even though they were in a position to get a 2-2 draw, ultimately they end up losing the game by a score of 3-2. And then I've kind of got like a manifesto about the LA Galaxy in that I think they've lost their way. And I think as much promise and competency there was in Dennis Toclosa and Guillermo Barros-Scalotto coming in and joining the organization, it hasn't really come through to fruition. Chicharito's been largely a disappointment, even though he did get his goal in the opening game of the tournament, albeit in a loss. And then obviously he conveniently had a calf injury. And I mean, if that's not a wake-up call to lose 6-2 to LAFC, where you completely drop off in the second half, and they were playing Zlatan ball, much that we've seen from the LA Galaxy in their previous games, but it was Zlatan ball with Chicharito being Zlatan, and it was Zlatan ball with Pavone, and he just didn't really have any help around him. And this is a team that is still too easy to pass through up the middle and defensively suspect. They have not had a competent center back since Yellow Van Dam left, and pretty much every single South American signing, Latin American player who they've signed under the current regime, with the exception of Pavone, has largely been a disappointment. So I don't know where the LA Galaxy go from here, but it feels like for the fourth straight year, I'm saying they need a rebuild. The difference is this is the rebuild on top of the rebuild of what was supposed to be competency, not Kurt Anolfo coaching LA Galaxy 1.5 and missing the playoffs, and not Chris Klein just promoting his buddies and them doing a terrible job of actually managing the organization. Let's move on to the round table, and we will get straight to Pick'ems. Rachel, break down our two NWSL semifinals, and then we will do our Pick'ems for those games.
Yeah, so like I mentioned earlier, I think that these games are going to be crucial in who gets on the ball in the attack and who finishes. Like I said, Morgan Weaver had the only goal of the entire quarterfinals, and all of the other matches went straight to penalty kicks because there is no extra time at the Challenge Cup. So I think it's going to be a game that needs to be, well, games, I should say, plural, that need to be focused on offense more than defense. I think right now these teams really have nothing to lose. Just go for it and just attack each other's net the entire time, and whatever happens, happens. So I think you have two really good games. I think these are quality teams that have performed admirably well in the group stages, albeit Portland did not win a single match in the group stage. They definitely were tinkering with a few things, and they looked good at times. And I think players like Raquel Rodriguez, Morgan Weaver have just been absolutely outstanding. But yeah, I think these are going to be really good games. Wednesday, Portland and Houston at 12:30 Eastern, and then at 10 p.m. Eastern, the last late game of the tournament, y'all. We are so close. Sky Blue and Chicago. So I think for the early game, as much as I want to pick the dash for the upset. I think Portland's going to come out and win this one, because I think that they just also have that experience of being in the playoffs and having that type of mentality, the type of win or go home mentality. Houston has never made the playoffs in their NWSL existence, so I think that they're trying to grasp that. Although I do think that James Clarkson is a really good coach, and I think he's really changed the culture down in Houston. But I'm expecting a lot more from Christine Sinclair, because she has been super quiet in this tournament, which is very unlike her. And then for the later game, I'm going to go with Sky Blue in this one. As much as Rory Dames knows about that playoff mentality, and many of the Red Stars do, I just think that Sky Blue has been a pretty complete team, albeit they haven't won every single game in the group stage. I think they had some good chances and some good looks. And I think overall, they were pretty good against Washington. They had a couple really good attacks. If they weren't going to win, I think Ife Onamanu was going to go to sleep dreaming about that header that she missed. So I'm going to go with Sky Blue going to their first final in quite a long time.
Dan, who you got and why?
So I am going to go with I think we're going to get a Houston versus Chicago Red Stars final. I'm all on the Red Stars train. We're going to have fun.
Of course you disagree.
I'm going to go with Portland Thorns and Chicago Red Stars to win and make it to the final. I think now maybe we don't know in the public space what's going on with Lindsay Horan or what her availability is going to be, either due to injury or potentially, like you were kind of suggesting, Rachel, where there's maybe some U.S. soccer influence on not wanting to burn out and harm these players. But in any case, the Portland Thorns internally have to know the likelihood of Horan's availability, and either she's available and there's a plan for that, or she's not available and the plan's not, and they have a second contingency plan for that. This is a team that still has a wealth of experience in league play internationally and in the playoffs. So I think that will see it through, though I do think this will be the closer of the other two ones. And I think this is finally the year that the Red Stars actually have something. Like I've already said, I am already on the Casey Short hype train. Julie Ertz has been really, really good in this tournament as well. So I think it's going to be the two experienced team, and that's going to kind of set up a battle between two teams that previously were the bridesmaids under the North Carolina Courage dynasty era reign of doom, where one of these teams is going to finally win a trophy and then get that off their back, and for the other one, it's just going to continue their inevitable coming up short that's been happening. So we'll see whether or not that's the final, but I'll be excited for it either way. And if I'm not mistaken, Rachel, will the final not be on Big CBS?
The final is on Big CBS at 12:30 Eastern on Sunday, July 26th, correct?
Excellent. And then let us head on to back to the MLS's back tournament. We will start with the first game chronologically in Group E this coming week. It will be Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern time. It is Atlanta taking on Columbus. Atlanta needs a win for any hope to make it to the knockout stage. Columbus already through, and if I'm not mistaken, it is still possible for Columbus to crazy stuff would have to happen, but it's not guaranteed that Columbus is finishing first in the group. Dan, I will throw it to you first. Who you got and why?
I'm going to take Columbus. They've just been the better team. I think they've got a very clear they've been able to take their foot off the gas for a lot of the second half of their games so far, especially that game against Cincinnati. They did a little bit of rotation against New York Red Bulls when was that game? Thursday. So I like what I've seen from Columbus so far. I just think that they're the more superior team. So I'm going to take a 2-1 win over Atlanta, sending them home.
Rachel.
Yeah, I agree. I just think Columbus has been better. They already got their apology out of me, so I'm going to go 3-0 Columbus. And Frank DeBoer is going to have a long ride home if Atlanta doesn't advance.
Yeah, I'm going to take 1-0 to Columbus on this one. I think this is a game where we could see a lot of roster rotation. Maybe Caleb Porter giving some of his key starters a rest. I would not expect, especially if they are up in the by the drinks break of the second half, whenever that occurs, that we will see that Giassi's artist, Lucas Nilarayan, Jonathan Mensah will have played every single minute of that game so far, and then we'll play all the way through to the final 90 minutes. So I think this is a game where Columbus comes out, maybe there's a little bit of squad rotation, and they're able to get a goal early and then really just control the result, knowing that if they get a draw, they're safe no matter what as far as the top seed. And I think especially with just where things are for Atlanta emotionally, the two players who they lost to red cards in their second game to Cincinnati, and then ultimately just the fact that they've done a good job finding the ball and getting it in the final third. They've gotten it to dangerous positions. But, I mean, this is a team that clearly is missing a striker. Jose Martinez is going to be available on Tuesday. So I'm struggling to see how Atlanta scores if Columbus plays their game defensively that we're used to. So I think this is going to be – it's going to be a boring second half in that Columbus is going to be up. They're going to rotate their squad. And they're just going to manage out the results through to seeing it, and it's going to be 1-0. I am super pumped, however, for this game to see whether or not we get 90 more minutes of Baby Berhalter, who so looks like a teenage version of Will Trapp in the way that he plays right now. Let us move on to our second game. This will be the night cap on that Tuesday, and it'll be 10:30 p.m. Eastern, DC United taking on Montreal Impact. Rachel, I will throw it to you first. Both of these teams pretty much need a win for any chance to make it to the knockouts.
I'm going to go with the upset here, and I'm going to go with Montreal defeating DC United. I think it's going to be close, but I think it's going to be 2-1. I just, like I said earlier with DC, it's one big slip up for them, and it could just be fiasco. So I'm going to go with Montreal in this one, and Thierry Henry having something to cheer about.
Dan.
Yeah, I'm going to go a 0-0 draw. Neither of these teams are, like, great. Actually, I'll say 1-1. They each have a goal in them, but, like, I'm usually severely disappointed with what I watch when I watch these two teams.
I'm going to take 1-0 to DC United in this one. I think it's going to be a mistake early in the second half from Montreal that ultimately gives the opportunity to United. And then we're just going to see total Benny Ball from a defensive standpoint. It's going to be ugly and it's going to be gritty and unconvincing, but it's going to be just enough for Ben Olsen to A, still keep his job with DC United, and B, get through to the knockout rounds. Let's move on to the games on Wednesday. We will start early. This is 9 a.m. Eastern on Wednesday. Sporting Kansas City taking on Real Salt Lake. Both teams with 3 points, or excuse me, RSL have 4 points. Sporting Kansas City have 3 points in Group D. Both pretty much, you know, either one gets a result and they will be one of the top two teams in Group D. Dan, who you got and why?
I'm going to take Sporting Kansas City. I believe in their depth. I believe in their chance creation. I don't believe in RSL without Albert Rusnak. So once Albert Rusnak is gone, they really have no true playmaker. Can we see Kyle Beckerman as a 10? That might be kind of fun. We're just going to get long shots and studs up challenges, though. So I'm going to say Sporting Kansas City. What did I say a score earlier? If I did, I'm just overcorrecting it. I'm going to say 3-1 Sporting Kansas City over RSL.
Okay, I have a fun story if you want to hear it later, Dan, where I interviewed Brian Dunseth for a preview from Rocky Mountain Cup, and he actually played Raimondo in high school, and Raimondo was a number 10 and a goalkeeper, so he would play. The high school rules were super weird in terms of substitutions and everything, so one half he would be goalie, and the other half he would be a number 10, and apparently by, like, you know, by goalkeeper standards at the professional level, still had some pretty good footwork if they were playing 5v2 and he was out of the box and not able to play with his hands in training with RSL. Don't know what's going on with Raimondo now, because obviously he's munching on some tacos and chilling as he deserves to do. Rachel.
I'm just kidding.
Does he eat shoes? He does not eat shoes. I apologize. I apologize to the slandering of Nick Raimondo from my little Freudian slip there. Rachel, who you got and why?
I can't get over Chacos right now.
Choco Taco?
It actually sounds somewhat good. I'm going to go with Sporting Kansas City. To be quite honest with you, I feel like Sporting and RSL's matches have some sort of confliction with NWSL, so I haven't really been able to see too much. But I trust in what Dan's saying, and I trust in the highlights that I've seen. And I know that RSL has not been impressive from what I've been reading about the tournament. So Sporting Kansas City, let's go a 2-0.
I'll take Sporting Kansas City 1-0 in this one. I agree with you, Dan, that, you know, pretty much everything with RSL offensively right now is through Albert Rusnak. He was on, and there was space for him to do things against Colorado, not so much against Minnesota United. And I also think just defensively, the game plan is going to be a lot less stressful for Peter Vermees and Matt Beisler with Tim Melia back from his red card suspension. So I think we're going to see a very defensively sound and resolute Sporting Kansas City, and I think there was enough that didn't go well for Alan Pulido on the whole in the 90 minutes that there'll be some adjustments there, either in terms of his performance or in how Peter Vermees is using him, that they'll be able to get space and ultimately create chances against Real Salt Lake. And then final game that we will be covering in Pick'ems today, this will be the night Wednesday game, Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, Cincinnati taking on New York Red Bulls. This game could be moot in the context of both teams probably being through if indeed Atlanta United do not defeat the Columbus Crew the day prior to that. But in the event that they do, Dan, you were suggesting some really funny things that could be going on between these two teams. Who you got and why?
So I'm going to go 0-0, and the entire game is just going to be one gigantic game of Rondo played at center circle for 90 minutes with three players from each team in the middle.
Rachel.
I'm going to go with a 1-1 draw. Don't really have too much to say, but I do like Frankie Amaya, and I really enjoyed his goal against Atlanta. So good luck to both, I guess.
All right. If I'm not mistaken, we'll just have one. We'll have the games in Group F and then one game in Group D that will have not been completed by the time this final game in Group E takes place. So pretty much we're going to know that both of these teams are going to know where they stand relative to the third place teams in Group A, B, and C. And they're going to have a really good idea of where Group D is shaping out. So I think we could see a pretty listless, let's rotate the squad, and maybe not a full-on handshake situation, Dan, but both teams knowing that if they just get a point, that they're both through no matter what. And so even if they aren't agreeing to it, I think we're going to see two teams that will be content to play for the draw, and they're not going to risk losing to try and win it. And in that, it's going to be one of the less exciting games. This is going to be as boring as probably Minnesota RSL was, but it'll be just enough for both teams to advance to the knockout round. And I think FC Cincinnati will take their third place, their metaphorical third place trophy, and probably hoist that up next to their USL regular season titles that they're also proud of there, Rachel. Let us head on to last words. I will throw it first to you, Dan. Dan, tell us about one of our sponsors, and do you have any last words? Where can people find you on Twitter?
I'm just going to start off with the sponsor read, I guess. Why not? Are you tired of the same old uniforms and cookie cutter templates from Nike and Adidas? Are you looking for a unique, completely custom kit for a youth club, Sunday league squad, adult, or even pro team? Icarus FC can help you create the kit of your dreams at an affordable price. With the motto, any design you want, seriously, let them help you design your new custom kit today at IcarusFC.com. You can find me on Twitter at SperryDaniel94. I have two quick takes. For my last words, one, as much as Rapids fans are going to hate this, upon review and rewatching of the game, I actually think the Diego Rubio call is correct. We can debate about the process of how they got there too, but if you watch it in real time in a live feed, you hear the shot, the sound of Graham Zusi's foot making an impact on the ball, followed very quickly as the ball reaches Diego Rubio with a very clear secondary thud, meaning it hit something. So if you go back and listen to it in real time and in live sound, and you'll hear that bam, the deflection goes out for a corner. So obviously they ruled it was going to be a corner kick anyways. So obviously Gantard knew that it deflected off of something. Then upon video review, they go and look through, and really at this point, the only logical place that the ball comes off of upon multiple review angles is his arm. Now, the problem with everybody else's is that it's not clear and obvious. If this was called in real time, a handball and a penalty kick, I don't think anyone would probably have a problem with it. And I don't think that. But the problem is how did we get to the right call? And it seems like Gantar and his team used VAR very similarly to how the Premier League has done. And I don't know if that justifies as a clear and obvious. But I understand how they came to the decision that they did. It was very clear and obvious that it deflected off of something, but it wasn't clear and obvious what it deflected off of. And if you use replay like that to slow it down frame by frame to try and figure out what it potentially deflected off of, and you come to the conclusion that because it deflected off of something, the only logical deflection that it came off of that we can find in replay is off the arm. Is it clear and obvious to overturn? That I don't agree with. However, I do think it was, in turn, it was the right call. And if it was made in real time, I don't think anybody would have necessarily had a problem with it. And the other point to it is how do you want Diego Rubidio to jump? You know what? DeAndre Yedlin got called for this in the opener of the 2016 Copa America Centenario. He had his back turned. And as he was turning, with his momentum turning, and his back arm was outstretched, the cross came in off of his backhand. He's not even looking at the ball. Comes off of his backhand. Colombia were given a penalty. They won that game 2-0 after James Rodriguez dispatched of that penalty kick. There's precedent for that. The rules, unfortunately, continue to set precedent for that handball being a legal play, and that's that. The second one is San Jose Earthquakes. Stop playing Andy Rios. He sucks. He scored a goal, but he's terrible. He is not the right striker for what you're trying to do. Please play Danny Huzin up top or play it as a 4-4-2 and throw Danny Huzin and Rios together up top. That is where you're going to find there. Also, flip Vaco and Magnus Eriksson. Give Vaco the ball inside. Let him run at defenders. Create chaos. Pull defenders in and out of position. The problem right now with him is he's just stuck out wide trying to loop across into freaking Andy Rios, who's not making any movement off the ball inside the 18-yard box. So, you know what? I understand wanting to bring on Wando as a super sub, as Wando's older, and you just want him to put, you know, pedal to the metal for 30 minutes, that's totally okay. But you either need to throw somebody else up top with Andy Rios, or you need to have someone underneath him truly creating chances going north to south in that zone right outside of the penalty area. Magnus Eriksson is constantly found with his back to goal in that position and sending it out wide for a cross that is met with zero movement inside the box and like maybe one dude in Andy Rios who is probably about as tall as I am. So we're not threatening anybody on a cross in the box. So there is some of the red light in the middle of Matt's San Jose Earthquakes yellow light. But those are my concerns. Those are just some rants. I hope they do it tonight. I doubt they will. But that's going to be it for me, I guess.
Yeah, your points are well taken on the situation with the Colorado Rapids and the PK there, Dan. I think, unfortunately, you know, if we're the best angle that we have, I think, makes it look like it goes off of Diego Rubio's hand. I don't know that we have an idealized angle, or at least it wasn't shown on the TV view. But I think, to your point of the outrage and the VAR, the cancel culture towards VAR, is there's a lot of cognitive dissonance, and it's pretty much centered around, does VAR overturn a call that makes me mad because it goes against my team, independent of whether or not it's the right call? I think it's the most right call. I think the handling of it and the timing behind it, just in terms of how long the delay took at that point, and just the angles that we were able to see on TV, were not the best. Maybe they had something better for the officials than what was being shown on the main broadcast, but that was the big problematic thing. But I mean, it's the same thing. You know, VAR overturns it and gives Manchester United a penalty call, and they're able to win against Chelsea today, Dan. You know, Man United Twitter is absolutely happy, and Chelsea Twitter is ready to burn down all of VAR that exists. Okay, but enough VAR ranting for one podcast. We've already done it a couple times. Rachel, your last words.
So I have two last words. First off, the Best We Know podcast has kind of rebranded, if you will. RJ and I brought on Andre Carlisle, who's another fantastic writer and great in the women's soccer community. And we are now on a show called the Pro Foul Podcast. RJ's running joke is that she's going to call it the Profile Podcast. So if you hear that every once in a while, it's the same thing. So we launched our first episode. It's pretty much an all NWSL show. With a little bit of world soccer, women's soccer in there as well. But we are recording again this week, and I hope you all continue to support that podcast as well. So my last words, I touched on this earlier with U.S. soccer managing minutes for the NWSL, and Anthony DiCicco, the son of the late, great Tony DiCicco, a World Cup winning head coach, had mentioned on Twitter something along the lines of, you know, if Greg Berhalter and U.S. soccer and the men's national team went to any of these MLS clubs and said, hey, we're going to manage your guys and we're going to manage minutes on our guys, the MLS clubs would look at them and just laugh in Greg Berhalter and U.S. soccer's face. And part of the reason about this is that, yes, NWSL has this kind of rule thing going on that there are federation contracts for these players and certain players on the U.S. women's national team. But at the same time, you know, it's different in than the MLS tournament because the points for that are going to a potential regular season this year, albeit personally, I don't think that's going to happen. This might be the only action for the NWSL this season. And on top of that, U.S. soccer does not have any scheduled friendlies for the U.S. women's national team. There are likely not going to be many friendlies ahead of the Olympics next year, if those even happen next year. And just with nothing really happening for the women's national team at the end, at all really in 2020 with matches and meetups and training, I don't understand, and I don't think this is in Vlatko's control. I think this is a higher up thing. I do not understand the micromanaging of players. I know that Richie Burke had said in his press conference after Washington lost to Sky Blue that he wanted Rose Lavelle starting the match, but he could only get her in the match for 30 minutes because U.S. soccer told him that's how much that she was going to get. I personally think that's ridiculous. I understand the federation contracts, but, and maybe I could be wrong about this, but I haven't seen this. Canada isn't doing that for their federation players in the NWSL. So why the heck is U.S. soccer doing it? I think it makes the federation look bad because I truly believe those players want to get in there and compete for their club teams. This is like the first time really in forever where the national team players aren't not necessarily distracted because tournaments aren't a distraction, but they are fully focused now on their club teams. They don't have to worry about, you know, preserving themselves for an Olympic call-up or a World Cup call-up or anything like that. So I think that it's a little pushy from U.S. soccer. I don't understand the micromanaging. And with a semifinal and a final coming up, I really hope that U.S. women's national team players can get some good minutes, albeit if they're healthy, because you don't want players to go out there at only like 60, 70% and then risk getting injured, of course. But if they want to play, then by all means, let them play. So those are my last words slash a second Rachel rant for this second week in a row. But you can find me on Twitter at Rachel Krieger.
I want to thank our other sponsor, Roughneck Scarves. They are an official scarf supplier of MLS, USL, and US soccer. They are also now making both generic multicolored MLS or soccer team licensed and customizable net gaiters, and then the N95 masks, but the ones that kind of have the Hannibal Bane shape with the Velcro that goes around your ears that are a little bit more sturdy than just the little bunny ear loops that you have that go around your sides as well. So they're very good. You can get your custom or soccer team apparel, scarves, neck gaiters, and masks at roughneckscarves.com. I want to clue everybody else still listening to this into a Twitter account, not soccer related, that I've become obsessed with in the last couple of weeks, and that is Jurassic Park Updates, that is a parody account basically just leaning into the similar to like the, oh, like, you know, the mayor in Jaws is going to open everything up in the parody that we've seen around the COVID-19 pandemic. And so some of their tweets include, the screaming is fine, we just checked it out, it was nothing, lol. If anyone sees a dinosaur like in a random place, let us know. Staff, please remember to close the T-Rex cage behind you when you leave, when you're done there. Last time I'm gonna say this, seriously. And just earlier today, as of scrolling through, it appears that the dinosaurs have asked for a Bill of Rights and are petitioning to unionize. So I think that's hilarious and stupid and totally chaotic, and it fits in with the times that we're living in 2020. Listeners, follow me on Twitter at LWSMattPollard. Check us out at LastWordSC across all social media platforms and LastWordOnSoccer.com. We have lots of great coverage coming in as the NWSL Chaos Cup wraps up and as we get into the final group stage games and the knockout stage of the MLS Is Back tournament. Listeners, we'll see you next time.